Blog Talk Radio.
Here we are, sort of. This week, new unemployment claims are down again, this time by about 11,000. For all of those of you with new jobs or those who've kept them, congratulations. Please feel free to send a thank you note to President Obama or to the Republicans who voted against providing funds for the stimulus package. Another mine cave in and another two deaths. The mine only received a bit over 200 notices of violation of worker safety rules in the last year. How about some solutions? Charlie Crist, governor of Florida, has announced that he's running for the Senate as an independent, to the surprise of exactly no one. In the British election debate, the conservative candidate is given a victory, but British Petroleum is unlikely to win any popularity contest along the Gulf Coast. The amount of oil they've spilled could be worse than the Exxon Valdez. BP is assuring everyone that oil's well that ends well. Well, never mind. Women will be permitted to serve on U.S. Navy submarines beginning in 2012. So announced Barry Bruner. He's a rear admiral. The Food and Drug Administration has approved a new immune-boosting therapy to treat prostate cancer, an entirely new approach that promises less toxicity in treatment. That's a good thing. The U.S. Supreme Court takes up a case to determine whether California's efforts to keep violent video games out of the hands of minors run afoul of the U.S. Constitution's First Amendment provisions regarding free speech. Sarah Palin, remember her? She's now made an endorsement in both the Minnesota governor's race and that in Kentucky, in the latter supporting the son of Texas Congressman Ron Paul. Might she be running for anything? Mr. and Mrs. America and all the ships at sea, welcome to Speaking of Everything with Jeff Bushman. All that, news of the weird, and our guest, writer and illustrator Scott Foster, who's going to talk to us, among other things, about his book, The Christmas Snowflake. Yes, I know it's April. But first, how about something free? That's right. To be receiving our regular newsletter with regard to Speaking of Everything, you can have it delivered to your email box by emailing me first. The address is jb720@cox.net. That's JB in the digit 720@cox.net. We didn't get it out this last week because life invaded, but we'll be sending out a two-week newsletter, and if you're interested in getting it, as I say, drop me a note. Once more, that's jb720@cox.net. And let's talk about these items we've discussed, and then we'll talk about news of the weird. We will be having Scott joining us at about 5 minutes before the hour. And I say before the hour because although it is 7:30 and small change where we are, it is, if you're on the East Coast, it's 10:30 or 10:32, provided you're listening live. And if you're not alive, then you're probably not listening. But anyway, the show does broadcast live at those hours, 7:30 Pacific time, until we go off daylight saving time. And if you are listening in archive edition and you are interested in listening live, we are on Thursday nights at that hour. And again, 7:30 Pacific, 10:30 East Coast. If you're in the Atlantic provinces of Canada, it would be 11:30, and you're not going to care, because especially during the winter, it's too cold to listen to a radio show on the Internet. In any event, let's talk about those things we initiated. If you wish to join us, you can do so at 347 area code 994-3796. The new unemployment claims are down. Housing sales are up. New house inventory is down. They're going to announce the gross domestic product estimate, I believe, tomorrow. It may be Monday. And it is highly likely that the gross domestic product will have increased in the last quarter, as it has previously, signaling further that the recession is over. Republicans are just falling all over themselves on the floor of both the House and the Senate to give credit to President Obama and the Democratic Congress for having passed the stimulus package and improved the economy. No, they're not. I'm kidding. But they should be. All what they will be saying is that, yeah, but we still have unemployment, because they know so much about economics and ignore the fact that it's a trailing indicator. As we've discussed on the show, it only improves long after the recession is over. And this unemployment statistic will be stubborn. This unemployment figure, rather, will be stubborn in terms of unemployment coming down. It's going to be a while. The good news is that inflation will not occur in large amount, or perhaps at all, until the unemployment rate is much lower. And if you think about why that is, you'll instantly get it, which is that inflation, classically, is the, I don't want to get too academic here, but it's the situation of too much money going after too few goods. So as long as demand increases, as long as factories are not at capacity, they'll keep producing and essentially selling it at the same price. When there are more people who want the good, who have money to buy it, then the goods they can produce, they will then raise prices. That's classic economics. Well, since unemployment is still high, there aren't that many people who have the money to go ahead and buy your widget or my book. And as a result, inflation will not occur. So if you are in a situation such as that of a friend of mine with whom I was discussing this yesterday, if you're in a situation, for example, where you have a variable interest rate, and interest rates are a concern of yours because obviously you'll pay more as interest rates go up, you can be reasonably assured that you're not going to have to pay too much more money on your mortgage, because that's going to be impacted by inflation, and, or more correctly, interest rates. And interest rates are a result of high inflation, because when inflation increases, the Federal Reserve Board increases interest rates to bring in that inflationary spiral. So for what it's worth, there's mostly good news, unless you're unemployed, in which case all news is bad with regard to unemployment until it improves enough for you to get a job. In any event, I want to talk a little more seriously about the mine cave-in today. That was in Kentucky. Two miners died. And by miners, again, we're talking about people who work in mines, as opposed to someone under the age of 18. Two miners died there, and this operator of the mines had a little over 200 notices. I think it was 216 notices of violation of worker safety rules in the last year. I have a respectful suggestion about how that might be resolved, but you may have a different idea, and if you do, of course, again, I invite your call to 347-994-3796. But why not make a rule or a law that's something like the following? Okay, just my humble suggestion. If if you have more than, say, five violations of worker safety rules, my preference would be one, but let's say five. If you have more than five violations of worker safety rules in your mine, you have to close the mine, pay all the miners at full salary until you fix the problems that are causing the violation, which has to be determined by an OSHA inspector. And if you don't begin progress on fixing the mine, fixing the problems that gave rise to the violation, if you don't start fixing it within, say, 10 days, and you own another mine somewhere else, whether it has violation problems or not, we're going to start closing your other mines one at a time every 10 days until you fix the problems. You have to hurt these folks where they live, because based on their history and their record, you have to believe that, okay, they may care about people dying in their mine, but they don't care enough. And so let's let them continue to care about the people who die in their mine, but now let's also cost them some money. Okay? If you think that's a good idea, call, email, or write your congressional representative. It may not do any good, but it couldn't hurt. When I say it may not do any good, they may not effectively write or pass that law, but they'll do something else. The fact is, something has to be done with regard to those mines and the miners. And you have to remember, this isn't just academic. The reality is, there's a reason they're mining all that coal. It's because we need it. Specifically, in the United States and throughout much of the so-called civilized world, or at least the industrial world, one of the reasons that we have to mine coal is because it is our primary source of electricity. To this day, We use oil in some areas more than coal, but in many areas, even though we do use oil, we still use more coal. We use coal for that. We use in order to create electricity here and around the world. We have not yet gotten to the point where we're really producing that much wind power, hydropower, solar power. Wish we were, but we're not. So until we get to a point where we can do that, and until and unless we get to a point where we're using far less electricity overall, we are going to be dependent upon coal that has to be mined by humans who go into those mines and get it out. So if we have to close a mine or two in order to get the companies who own those mines to make them safer, that's okay, because they're not going to keep them closed very long because they need the money. And more importantly, like most of us, they like the money. The British election is coming up on May the 6th, and the last of the three televised debates among the three major candidates took place today, at least today American time. And the Conservative candidate, David Cameron, was given a victory by most people polled. Apparently he did the best among the three candidates. If you don't know the difference, by the way, between the use of between and among, I, Professor Henry Higgins, will go ahead and explain it to you. Between is two people. Between you and me, not between you and I, please. Between you and me, or between the two of them, yes. But if there's more than two people, you can't say between the three of them. No, among the three of them. Frankly, if you make that kind of mistake, it won't get you jailed. Unless I had my way. It won't get you jailed, but it will mark you among people who know how to speak the language as being less knowledgeable than you might wish to appear. Women and submarines. Beginning in 2012, women and men will be on submarines. Initially, it'll only be some officers and among the women, and they are looking at ways to create quarters where there's not too much fraternization. One of the folks in the Navy said, 20 years from now, we're going to look back at this and ask what all the fuss was about. I think that's probably true. The reality is that there will be more pregnancies. And that's going to be true anytime you put men and women together, depending on how you put them together, of course. But you're going to have some more pregnancies. You're going to have some more problems. But that's the price you pay. It's not going to be devastating. There will be some people who violate rules. If you have men and women in any situation, you're going to have some people who are going to violate rules. And the victims of that are almost always women, frankly. But if they're willing to be pioneers and take that chance, why should we not let them? It's just another form of integration in the military, which, as a rule, tends to lead to greater integration in our society. And in this case, the military, or specifically the Navy, is a little behind society. Women are all permitted to work in most kinds of work sites. The Navy has been the submarine corps within the Navy has been the last bastion of sexual segregation. The U.S. Supreme Court, as mentioned, is going to be hearing a case based on a California law that was knocked down by a federal appeals court in San Francisco because they said it was a violation of free speech and free expression, as well as due process. Here's what happened. California passed a law which required the rating of video games for violence. And, excuse me, and the federal appeals court, well, let me back up, and once a game reached a certain high level of violence, it could not be sold to people under the age of 18 years old. The lawsuit was brought, and the federal appeals court in California, San Francisco specifically, had ruled that the state couldn't do that. It was too much of a restriction on the free speech and expression of those whom it was designed to affect. And the state appealed it, and the U.S. Supreme Court has decided to hear argument. And when they do that, they will make a determination as to whether that's going to stick or not. By the way, I will share with you that we have some minor technical problems this evening. The internet connection has slowed to a crawl, so I may not be exactly accurate when I give you a time reading, and I may not know precisely when our guest calls in or if one of you call in. I may not get to you right away because as a result of that slowdown, it's not altogether clear that I'm getting things in real time. So, of course, if you're listening in archive edition, that's not going to matter a lot. But that said, if you hear something and it sounds like I'm confused, I might be, but it's only because of what's happening with the internet connection, but we should be okay. So we talked about California. Oh, we have news of the weird, and we've only got about 10 minutes, if I'm reading this right, or 9, before Scott Foster joins us, and you want to be listening for that. Scott has written and illustrated a really, I don't want to say cute, because I don't want to demean it in a way that makes me sound patronizing or make it sound like the book is not meaningful and interesting. Yeah, the book has been described as magical, and I think that's probably a better word for it. It's really interesting, and yes, it's about Christmas, but it's not about religion, and it's something we'll talk about more, so keep tuned, as they say. Stay tuned! Anyway, news of the weird. I want to give you the reading on these stories. Again, this comes from newsoftheweird.blogspot.com. This is not something I write. This is something written by, I can't remember his name, unfortunately, but it's a column you sometimes see in your newspapers, and that website will give you a lot of laughs and a lot of enjoyment, but if you don't have a sense of humor, don't go there. Before I talk about News of the Weird, however, let me mention to those of you who have a business and have a website that if you're not blogging, you're missing the best thing you can do for yourself in terms of driving eyeballs to that website and chasing dollars to your bottom line. You can do blogging yourself and not have it cost you anything, and if you think that's a better idea or you really can't afford anything else, which is highly unlikely, but if that's the situation, go ahead. If you have some capacity to be an interesting writer, do that. You'll really improve your business. But if you don't want to do it yourself or don't feel capable, call me or go to my website and take a look at more information about our company, Blog Wizardry. And the place where you can find out more about that is Jeff on Blogging, as if that were one word. That's jeffonblogging.blogspot.com. You'll be doing yourself a favor. Let's talk about News of the Weird. For those who think that all of Europe is less racist than the United States, think about this one. A British family, the Rodney Morgan family, intending to spend a great deal of money for a stay at the 5-star Ritz-Carlton in Florida, wanted assurance that he and his party would not be served by people of color or people with foreign accents. This is a British family, which is why it's mentioned, even though what you're about to hear is worse and does reflect racism in the United States, or greed, or both. The Ritz, according to the lawsuit that was filed over this, said, of course, we'll take care of that for you. So that these folks were going to be not sullied in some way by being served by people of color or people with foreign accents. Okay. Another story. There's a couple of really strange ones. We were talking about coal before and energy. Here's a story that relates to that. William Taylor in Northern Ireland, and you may have seen this story because it actually did hit the general news media last week, said he can provide 6% of the world's power needs. That is, he can provide 6% of the world's energy if farmers would buy the product he's producing, which is a treadmill designed for cows. What he has said is that if farmers will put their cows on the treadmills, the cows walking on the treadmills, being hooked up properly, would generate enough electricity to supply 6% of the world's energy needs. Now, the only problem that anyone has brought up is how do you get the cows to keep walking on the treadmills? But, you know, I suppose maybe you put, what do cows like to eat? Cows like to eat hay, right? Grass. Okay, I suppose if you put, like, AstroTurf in front of them, they'd keep walking, but, you know. Okay, let's see, what else have we got? Okay, Thomas Hovis Jr., age 52, in Albion, Indiana, thought he'd found a great hiding place when he was trying to get away from the deputies. He said he figured apparently they'd never think of looking there, and he was wrong. Okay, where did they find him, you might ask? Standing neck deep in a manure pit in the outbuilding of a farm. They found him there, so he ended up picking a really crappy hiding place, I guess, and there you are. This next one, there's actually two stories together, but before I tell you those, in about 4 or 5 minutes, we're going to be joined by Scott Foster, who's going to be talking about the book I mentioned. If you want to join us before that, feel free. If you want to join us after Scott has and you have some questions or comments to make about his book or anything else we've been talking about, although I would ask you to mostly discuss his book when you call when he's on. The number to do that is 347-994-3796. I'm going to go to the weirdest story and what is in a peculiar way the funniest first, in case we don't have time for something. I want to make sure we get this. This one sounds like a joke, but apparently it's real. A man named Ricardo West, age 22, performs as a Michael Jackson impersonator. He was recently arrested in Allen Park, Michigan, and charged with allegations that he was guilty of 12 counts of sexual abuse of an 11-year-old boy. The impersonation has gone a little too far, apparently. Okay, not saying that Michael Jackson ever did that. I was never convicted. And in the few minutes we have remaining before Scott joins us, Andrew Wildman, 28, became a former civics teacher at Cedar Cliff High School in Pennsylvania after at least 8 students reported that he generously gave extra credit for things like getting girls, schoolgirls, children, to lick the chalk dust off his fingers. Okay, let me give you a weirder one. Daniel Dupuis, also 28, teaches elementary and middle school music. That is, he teaches it to elementary and middle school teachers. Now, this story is a little hard to tell, but he admitted to at least 5 instances of, putting it gently, relieving his randy emotions into the trash can in his classroom. A janitor reported him because the trash can smelled bad. Now, if you don't know what the word randy means, you can ask a British friend. Okay, here we'd call it horny. And if that story's not disgusting, I mean, it's funny in a weird way, but if that story's not disgusting, I don't know what disgusting is. And I know disgusting better than most, I want to tell you. Anyway, that's basically the totality of the news of the weird, but you can get far more of them if you like that sort of thing by going to newsoftheweird.com or newsoftheweird.blogspot.com and bring your sense of humor. The other thing I wanted to tell you is next week we have the return of Larry Hancock, who is going to be talking a little more about the Robert Kennedy assassination. And I know that a lot of you like hearing Larry, and I do too. He does very well on the show, in spite of who's interviewing him. But that should be interesting for us. And please join us, if you will. As they used to say, same bat time, same bat station, which tells you approximately how old I am. Wanted to also let you know that our book, The Mobile Millionaire, can be found at Mobile Millionaire, again, as if all of that were one word, mobilemillionaire.blogspot.com. The book deals with mobile home investment as a means of building wealth and income, primarily for the small investor. Among other things, that book will tell you how to get involved with that for either little money or actually none. And you have adequate credit to get involved in that already in your wallet. It's made of plastic. I won't say any more, but you can look at the website and you can actually read on that site an excerpt from the book. And then you can decide whether it's worth your time and money to go ahead and pick up a copy right there on the website. It takes PayPal and anything else you want to deal with. Again, we are at 347-994-3796. So we've told you about next week. We've told you about the archive. Well, you know about the archive. If you are listening to the show and you want to listen to past shows, you can do that by looking on the site. There are shows in archived edition for listening, and I would only ask you not to listen to the first couple of shows because they were terrible. But if you can work within that limitation, of course, please feel free to listen to that. And again, join us each week here. We go live regularly at 7:30 Pacific time. Right now, we're just waiting until Scott joins us. So if you would like to get on the queue, so to speak, and be prepared to do that, you can call us at the number we've given out 17,000 times, and I won't bore you with again. Beyond that, we'll tell you about some books that we're reading now, but we'll do that after we've spoken to Scott, because if I'm right, we're being joined right now by Scott Foster. Scott, are you there?
I am.
Okay. Yep. How are you?
Good. Doing real good.
Good. Good. I want to tell you that I read your book, read and looked at, because as we'll discuss further, it's more than text. It's illustrations. Now, I believe you did those illustrations, right?
That is correct, yes.
I got to tell you, first off, I thought they were very nice, but I don't, you know, and again, that's almost damning with faint praise. They're really terrific. But my wife, who's an artist, looked at them, and she said something like, well, she kept saying, wow.
Oh, okay.
But then she also said, this man is tremendously talented. So there you are.
You. Well, thank you very much. And that wraps up the show for this evening. And
thank you and good night.
Yeah, thank you and good night.
Oh,
that's good. Well,
but
thank
no,
you so much. I appreciate that.
Yeah, yeah. And so that people can take note of it before we go further, and I don't want to mess this up. I hope I'm remembering correctly. The name of the book is The Christmas Snowflake, right?
It's called The Magic Snowflake.
And I was wrong. The Magic Snowflake. Okay. This is what happens when you make notes in too big a hurry. But it does relate, of course, to Christmas. And by the way, I have to ask you a side note question because it has nothing to do with anything. The state you're calling from is?
South Carolina.
Okay. All right. Because I noticed in your acknowledgments that among the people you were thanking was Michael Congdon, who's been a guest on our show.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And he, I believe, he may be in South Carolina now. Is he in South Carolina or North Carolina? I don't remember.
He's in South Carolina. Yep.
Oh, he is. Okay. Oh, that's right. But he was born in North Carolina, in a city that that is the home of another guest we interviewed. That's why it's like a three-way connection suddenly. So I was just making sure. Okay. Yeah. First off, let's talk about where someone can get The Magic Snowflake. If someone is interested, this was a limited edition type of book. I gathered from the cover from the one of the front pages that I saw.
I printed 1,000 books last year and
mm-hmm.
released them and fortunately sold out of them, but I'm doing another release of the non-limited edition books, and that'll be available this October. Yeah.
Okay, so that'll be available in October. I'm sorry?
Mm-hmm. But I'm going to go ahead and do a pre-sale on them. So if somebody is interested, they could go to the website, themagicsnowflake.com,
okay.
Or they can go to Scott. Scott Foster Creations, and that will also get you all the information you need to, you know, place an order.
Okay, great. Now, the book is I should add here, I guess, I don't want to, you know, let my biases be known, but one of the reasons I really like the book is because although it's about Christmas and it's about magic in a sense, and it's about boyhood and growing up and all kinds of really great things. It is also, though it does relate to Christmas, it has nothing to do with religion. You can enjoy this no matter what religion you have or don't have. It's really a very enjoyable and kind of magical and, if you will, I hesitate to use this word, spiritual read.
Thank you for noticing that. Yes, when I had written this book, I tried to write it in the perspective of just a boy discovering what Christmas is really, well, not really all about, but about the magic behind it and why there's different Santas in the world and that sort of thing, more the magic end of it.
Yeah, and it was very well done. And as I said, those illustrations are beautiful. When someone goes to that website, magicsnowflake.com,
uh-huh.
will they see some sample illustrations or some sample text?
They will. Yeah, I have. There's about 6 illustrations that rotate on that website.
That's
and
great.
And a little bit of the text. But I am in the process of redoing the website completely. It'll have mm-hmm. more text and more images, and also a video that I'm producing on this book and also on the future books that are following this. So
okay,
you'll be able to see all that.
Let me ask you the obvious and dumb-sounding question. How did you get the idea for the book?
Boy, it's funny. I was born and raised in Michigan. And did a lot of sledding back in the 70s. We had snowmobiles, and I built snow forts, and again, did a lot of outdoor activities during the wintertime. Love it, miss it. And
sure.
I moved down south back in 1980 to Georgia, and I've been missing the snow since. And the idea came from when I was a boy, I used to hike out in the woods in the wilderness and just go exploring. Often
right.
wonder what it'd be like just to come across an object in the middle of nowhere that doesn't make sense. That's something that is magical. And since I have a love for sledding, that's where the idea came from, was walking out in the woods and discovering a sled way up in a tree.
Yeah.
And wondering what it, you know, how it got up there and what it was up there for. And then it followed with the snowflake idea. When I was a boy, I used to catch snowflakes on my tongue and make wishes, and I thought everybody did that. But moving down south, I discovered that that wasn't the case. So I wanted to introduce that in this book.
Great. And it comes across well. I must tell you a couple of quick things just you know to share with you. First off, it reflects on, I guess, the place you are. I don't mean the geographical place, but the emotional, you know, mental space you're in. When you say, I thought of what it would be like to come upon an object that was completely out of place and figure out how, you know, how it got there and all of that. See, you wrote a very, again, I'm sorry to repeat the word and be redundant. You wrote a very magical book with great illustrations. Based on that premise, somebody else would have written a murder mystery with this.
That's right.
They would have come upon a body or, you know, a shotgun or something instead of a sled in the tree. That, you know, but this works well. Works very well.
Thank you.
And I assume you had dogs when you were growing up.
We did. Actually, a lot of the characters in this book are either people mm-hmm. I know or pets I've had in. The dog in the book is named Finnegan, and it's one of those
right.
dogs I had as a child growing up that was considered my little brother. Those who have pets understand it was extremely intelligent and just full of personality. It was almost like it was human. And that dog passed away quite a few years ago, so I wanted to incorporate him into the book. And the boy that's the main character is Bradley, and I just happen to have a son who's 10 years old that looks just like this, and his name is Bradley. So, and then the rabbit, there's a rabbit named Snowsy.
Right.
That is a rabbit that I own named Nosy. yeah, there's a lot of characters. My father is one of the Santa Clauses in here.
Oh, great.
Yeah. So it's been a joy to incorporate, again, people, places, and things that I love into this book.
Well, I want to talk to you more about that book, but I also want, and your background in history, but I also want to make note that you have a sequel coming out.
I do. It's called The Magic Sled, and it picks up where this book leaves off. My son is 10 years old in the book, and the book will it somewhat ends, but my son goes to sleep Christmas Eve, and the next book, The Magic Sled, picks up on Christmas morning. And it goes through 50 years worth, well, I don't want to give the book away, but it goes through 50 years worth of training that Bradley goes through for the opportunity to become Santa Claus. And that's what I wanted this book to to read. There's a lot of questions about the North Pole and why there's Santa's helpers in the world and how Santa Claus mm-hmm. can deliver presents in one night. And this book clears that up. And the books to follow, there's a 10-year series I'm planning on that will mm-hmm. have mysteries of the North Pole and Santa Claus in each one. So hopefully it'll be like a handbook. If anybody has any questions how things work out there, we'll do it. This will clear that for you.
In Santa Claus land.
You got it.
Yeah, that's great. And tell us about your background in art, how you developed an artist's eye, if you will, and also what your history and background is in terms of learning how to illustrate. I assume you do more than that, but in terms of illustrating for a book, have you illustrated other people's books previously?
Well, it started off, I've been drawing for a long time. My mother's an artist, and I was probably drawing before I could read, and that love eventually went into me going into college. I started off to study architecture. I was going to be the next great Frank Lloyd Wright, but discovered that wasn't the direction I wanted to go in, so I went into art college in Savannah College of Art and Design to study illustration. Mm-hmm. But I specialized in architectural renderings, architectural illustrations. Huh. And so that love and that interest kind of did a full circle on me. And but I ended up specializing in watercolors, doing a lot of watercolor portraits, again, renderings, and started a company called Scott Foster Creations, doing portraits of pets and prize roosters and show cars and everything in between. But this is my first book as far as illustrating and writing goes. And it's
mm-hmm.
been one of those dreams. But no, I have not illustrated for anybody else as far as books go. This is the first one, and it was just a joy.
I'm sure.
That's a story in itself.
Yeah, if it's something you enjoy, then obviously it would be great to be able to do that both for your own book or in general terms, in terms of your art, being able to make a living at it. As you know, that's rare in the art world.
Yeah, it can be difficult. And fortunately, I had a company, I ran the company for 7 years, and then about a year ago, I was working for a company, a developer, as a marketing director. And it's kind of
mm-hmm.
interesting how that happened, but I did all their architectural renderings, and I worked for him for a total of 4 years. And then, unfortunately, mm-hmm. with the market fell apart, everybody lost their jobs there.
Right.
And this book was a dream for years to write and illustrate. And I finally just sat down and said, well, here's my chance. And it took me 8 months to write and illustrate. And I said, here's a dream that I've been, thinking about for years, and it's finally going to come true. And I made it happen and had the right people around me, obviously, to put this thing together.
Right, that's a big help. But I am frankly surprised that it only took you 8 months. Because, okay, let me acknowledge, writing comes fairly easily to me, and I can do stuff quickly and so forth. But not that quickly in terms of everything that went into it. I mean, granted, it's not a long book in terms of a lot of text, and it's actually not a long book, period. But it's obviously work, and I would think that the creation of the illustrations would have taken you, and then getting them done and putting the whole thing together in terms of a print edition would have taken enormously longer. I've talked to authors who've taken years to write a book.
Yeah, it's funny. I didn't realize this until after I did it, that
probably that was better.
Yes, that's what I'm thinking. It's people can't believe that it took me only 8 months to put this book together from start to finish. And it's mm-hmm. funny about the writing aspect. That doesn't come as easily to me as painting does.
Right.
And where it was made for you. And the painting, mm-hmm. For me, I've been doing it for so long that perhaps it's the tricks that I know and the comfortable I have with it. I was able to just sit down and I could see the illustrations in my head before I even put the written word down. It was funny. A lot of times I'll do a painting then write around the painting rather than the other way around.
Right.
But it did go fairly quickly for me. And it's even the storyline was one of those where when I started writing, I had the beginning, I had the end, I had a little bit of the middle, but I didn't have the other pieces. And so there was the challenge of filling in the gaps.
Mm-hmm.
And fortunately, I have a friend of mine named Robin Stringer, who's a creative writer, and she was able to come in after I had written the manuscript and help, you know, place it or put it together a little bit more smoothly than I would have. So, again, it's I think the second book is actually a bigger challenge than the first one, to be honest with you.
Why is that?
You know, it's, I guess it's the challenge of following up with a book that I've been thinking about for 6-7 years, and then following up again with a book that perhaps has the same magic in it that would mean as much.
Right, I can understand that would be somewhat difficult to repeat it in that sense, that is to repeat the achievement. And there's also, you know, I don't know whether you're aware of this or not, but there is, first off, in sports, I guess it started in baseball, there's something called the sophomore jinx. You may have heard of that in terms of baseball. And I know that there's a friend of mine who listens who is a major baseball fan, and if it turns out that that's from basketball, he's going to be on my backside. But I'm not that much of a sports fan. But, you know, talking about, you know, somebody having a great first year and then they come back and it's not so hot, the best example that I recall from when I was, I don't know if I was still a kid, but very young, was Fernando Valenzuela on the LA Dodgers. But the thing is, there's also something of that in the writing and publishing field. You'll have somebody who has a major hit. I don't want to scare you, but I'm saying, and it doesn't always happen, obviously. You'll have someone who has a major hit, and they come out with a second book, and it's lousy. I should say the sales are bad, and often it's because, in fact, the book is lousy, but there are other reasons why sales are either good or bad. And one of the reasons I think that second books sometimes are not as successful from any standpoint is because that and this is, I'm sure, not true of you, but because that person really wasn't expecting it to be a hit, didn't plan on it that way, obviously, and put together something as quickly as possible because they wanted to capitalize on the success of the first one, and that almost never works. Greed is a very bad way of achieving something.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And that is, again, that is the fear, and I'm doing my best not to let that influence the creativity and stall it, you know, and it's, because what I'm hoping to do with this second book is it won't be as long as the first one.
Yeah.
It'll be a story that picks up, again, where the first one leaves off, but also when it ends, it sets up for the third book.
Great.
It's been a challenge, I must say, but...
Well, you do have the advantage of being the artist who will create the illustrations, and to some extent, I'm sure from what you said, that will drive the story and, of course, the writing of that story.
Mm-hmm. I think kind of so. Like, I see images. Yeah.
Kind of like, okay, now that I see what I've painted, and I assume that's what the process is. You had said it's watercolor, so yeah, it would be painting after the drawing. You see that and say, okay, now let's see what I've got. Okay. Now I know what I need to write.
That's right. You know, it's funny because Chris Van Allsburg wrote Polar Express.
That name is familiar, but I don't know why.
Yeah, Polar Express. He wrote that book and many others. And I'm a big fan. He's also from Michigan, sort of thing. But that book has really been an inspiration for me. And I read about his process of writing, and he does something very similar. In his mind, he actually goes on the journey first and then writes about it or paints first.
Mm-hmm.
I felt like that's the best way for me to handle this is just to go on the journey that my son takes to the North Pole and what he experiences, and I can actually see it in my mind's eye, and then I'll paint
right.
it. And then, like I said, just right around that. So that's kind of what that's kind of the process I'm in the middle of now. And not overthinking it, keeping it simple.
Right.
Not overwriting, because that first book there is fairly lengthy for a children's book, I feel. But I didn't want to remove the elements, like Mr. Gup, the snowman, and the other things.
Right.
It's almost like a Wizard of Oz journey. If I take one element out, I just don't think you get the complete story.
It doesn't hang together as well. When I said I know what you mean. I don't agree that it's necessarily, you know, long for a children's book, because frankly I'm ill-equipped to answer that because I don't read a lot of children's books. But that brings me to another point, which is since you sold the book directly, to some extent, you had contact with all of your customers. Were do you know, were those books being bought primarily for children, or were there a lot of adults who bought it for their own use? You may not know that, but I'm just wondering if you do know it, what the situation was.
Well, this is what I found. It was really, again, being my first book and experiencing all this for the first time, the book signings and whatnot and the presentation,
right.
I had a lot of customers come up, and they were buying it as gifts for children. But many mm-hmm. of the adults decided to buy one for themselves because it brought mm-hmm. back memories for them, being a child again in the snow in the winters up north or wherever it was and sledding, and they shared
yeah.
those stories with me.
Right.
So to answer your question, I think it's a combination of
yeah. I can easily understand that. I will tell you that had I not been exposed to this through you for the purposes of having this conversation, this is not a book that I would have picked up in the in a bookstore if you had been selling like that. And I also don't know that I would have, if someone handed me the book, say, "Oh, Magic Snowflake," right? And I probably would read about a page. I would not be interested in it myself. Now, having read it, I thoroughly enjoyed it, and I acknowledge that my initial reaction would have been wrong. Okay,
mm-hmm.
But there are adults who don't have my cynical viewpoint, and the best example I can think of is my lovely bride, who again, when I showed this to her, she just glommed onto it. She thought it was terrific, fabulous, all the positive adjectives I could mention. And I know you do, there are a lot of adults who, for example, read Harry Potter books, or who have bought a lot of adults who have read, again, for their own benefit, Anne of Green Gables and so forth, things that were really originally designed for children. But clearly there are a lot of adults who have the magic of childhood in them who really would be interested in this. I'm not trying to tout your book. I'm just saying that's absolutely present there.
Thank you. Yeah, that's I was surprised by that and thankful for it. Being an adult, 48 years old myself, I still think like a child, I swear.
Mm-hmm.
And love living in that world, and I appreciate the fact that others feel the same way. So it's a book that I know it. Children age 5 and 6 and 7 seem to really appreciate the illustrations.
Mm-hmm.
Kids are going into the 4th, 5th grades, 10, 11, 12-year-olds really seem to get it and be captivated by the storyline even more so.
Mm-hmm.
It gets a little deep in areas.
Yeah, one of the reasons that kids would be captivated by the story is because it's really a twist on a story, not a story, but on an image, and I guess partly a story, that they've heard all their lives, but never with this kind of approach. And I'll just say that the book, and you've already revealed this, so I'm not doing any, this is not a spoiler. The book involves kids meeting Santa Claus, a young boy's meeting Santa Claus, a boy and his dog meeting Santa Claus. And it takes off from there, but that's the essence of it. So normally, when you're talking about Santa Claus, there's basically it's a one theme story. Santa Claus delivers presents on Christmas, and spends the time in the North Pole and jolly and ho 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 and ha. That's it.
Mm-hmm.
But you've obviously done a lot more than that, and as I say, given it a new twist.
Yeah, I wanted to fill in the gaps. I felt like there was a there's a missing story there. What happens between the lines and the off season? What happens in the preparation? And what happens when Santa Claus comes? Gets back to the North Pole. And
well, the answer, by the way, is he reads catalogs.
Oh, is that it? I was wondering.
See, there you go. Yeah, see, unlike you and I, who may read seed catalogs in the winter, during the summer he reads gift catalogs, so, he's prepared. But anyway.
It is. I've always wondered.
Yeah. See? Glad I could help.
Yeah, thanks. I'll incorporate that in the next book.
There you go. That's number 3, right?
Yeah. It's funny because the elves at the North Pole will be incorporated, introduced in some of the books coming up. And I believe that this next one, The Magic Sled, that there'll be a brief encounter with an elf. And so that will set up for probably book number 3. That'll be all about the elves at the North Pole and how that whole entire operation works. So looking forward to that.
Yeah, I would assume that that's... I thought you were going to have a longer sentence, so I took a sip of my tea.
Sorry about that. Let me continue. Anyways.
no, that's funny.
I've been in touch.
You know, one of the things that occurred to me is, I don't know if you remember this from your youth, and you're younger than I am, but I don't know if you have the experience of seeing a lot of, I don't know what you would call it, I guess short films designed for children, which would obviously be illustrated. In some cases, they were not fully animated, but you would see the characters, and then you'd have dialogue, and then you'd see them in another position. I don't know how to describe that except not fully animated. And there would be stories like this. I seem to recall seeing one from a film festival or something that may have been from Central Europe. But in any event, what occurred to me as I was reading this is that this would be an excellent short film or DVD or whatever for kids.
Yeah.
Well, you know, if you could make that into it. Go ahead.
Yeah, it's... I can't even tell you how many times people have asked me when it's coming out as a full-length movie or short film. And it just so happens I have a friend that I've participated in some of his short films in Augusta, Georgia. And we're looking seriously at putting together a short film on that book, and in hopes that perhaps it'll go to a full-length movie at some point. But
you know, if you made a short film of it and it was I don't know anything about marketing those things, and I'm not trying to pretend knowledge I don't have, but it seems to me that if you made a short film of that, you know, and produced it on DVD, even if it was just offered from the website, but you obviously could get, you know, hopefully better distribution than that. But if you did that, first off, the reissuance of the book would help drive the DVD sales and vice versa. But more than that, once that was out and available, and then you produce either the second book or the second and third book, then you might have enough for, in fact, a full-length film.
Very
but
true.
It seems perfect. Seems perfect for that medium.
Yes. Yeah, it would be. It's funny that I've been thinking about that short film, if it needed to be animated at all, and there's a chance it would have some, but it could be just a true-life film based with my son, of course, as the main character, walking in the snow. And this sled that he finds in a tree, I actually built one. Full scale. I sent a photo to you, I believe, and it's...
Yes, you did. I saw it, but it was a little hard to see on my screen through no fault of yours. That's a problem here. But no, that was... But yeah, I saw that.
Yeah, building that, and... I take that with me when I give presentations to schools and read the book to them, and
great.
I unveil that at the end. And but what I found with that sled is that it's such a conversation piece and a lead-in for people that come in for the book signings. They've never seen one like it, and brings, again, back memories when they were sledding as children. And we're looking at taking that sled and turning it into sleds that could be purchased by the general public. And that could be part of the short film process also. So,
I think you've got an industry ready to break into.
We have a jewelry line that goes with it. It's funny. I tell you, it's one of those things where I kept going and going. I finally had to pull the reins back. But I have a love for designing. I should have been an industrial designer. And during the process of writing, I designed a snowflake. It's an 8-sided snowflake, which doesn't exist in nature, I was told, only 6-sided.
Sure.
But at the North Pole, 8-sided snowflakes exist, and that's how you know.
There you go.
I produced a line of necklaces and earrings that are made out of sterling silver at a limited run, and we sold a bunch of them, and I'll be producing a new snowflake for this year. So there's the product line that's been going with it, and I have a lot more ideas, but again, I had to finally just stop, you know, and take a breath.
Well, it does sound, however, like it keeps you busy.
Very much so. And I love every moment of it. And
Well, that's great. I mean, the recession turned out to be a good thing for you in a number of ways.
It really has. I was kicked out of the nest, so to speak, and forced into doing something different. And fortunately, mm-hmm. something that I really loved and was hoping to do at some point in my life. But again, without that opportunity, I would have just put it on the back burner all the way up to the day I die. So I'm very fortunate.
Right. Forced opportunity is sometimes the best kind, because it pushes you into doing something you wouldn't have otherwise had the guts to do.
Very true. Very true.
Yeah.
And
that's
we sold the books between November 6th and December 24th, and it couldn't have gone any better. And again, I encourage anybody who has that thought or dream is to go ahead and go after it, because I had just enough knowledge of the process to be dangerous and to figure it out. You know, one of those where, and again, fortunately, I had people that knew more about it than I did around me, and I'm still trying to get more information to help with the marketing. You know, this book was marketed here locally and a little bit beyond, and we sold 1,000 books at $40 a piece. I treated it like a limited edition heirloom quality book, which it is. It sold when it shouldn't have, I guess, at that price point. But the book that's being released, the new release of it, will be $18.95. But this book now will go out to South Carolina, the whole entire state, and North Carolina and some in Georgia. So it's been a challenge figuring that process out, and self-publishing along the way, too.
Yeah, I'm sorry we didn't get much of a chance to talk about that. We have about 2.5-3 minutes left, but... you know, that obviously is a whole other kettle of squid in terms of that process, because a lot mm-hmm. of people, you know, one of the things that I'm trying to remember who it was I spoke with, but I believe it was a literary agent. I've had a couple on the show, and she was talking about the fact that most not a literary agent, it was a publicity agent for authors. I'm thinking of somebody specific. In fact, I think it may be the person who got you and me in touch with each other. You're familiar with Sabrina?
Oh, yeah. That's her.
Yep. Okay. Yeah. Sabrina Sumason is who we're talking about, who's a very well-known publicity agent for authors. But I think it was she who told me that most self-published authors had better see it as a hobby, because they're not going to make a living at it, because for a variety of reasons, one of which is they don't know how to get publicity for their books. Mm-hmm. And in your case, obviously, you've succeeded where others have failed. So, you know, especially for someone who hasn't done this before, that's really quite remarkable. Quick question for you. If someone wishes to get in touch with you so you can make a presentation or appear to sell either the book when it's available, they can do that through the website, magicsnowflake.com?
Yes, I can. Or they can email me directly at scott@magicsnowflake.com.
Before I let you go, the Magic Snowflake, is it themagicsnowflake.com or just magicsnowflake.com?
Themagicsnowflake.com.
Okay, good. I want people to be able to get to you and also take a look at the book and what's going on and all of that. The second book, you say, is coming out again as we approach the holidays?
It will. Somewhere between the middle of or end of October will be The Magic Sled. Yeah, it will be available as a limited edition book, signed and numbered.
Mm-hmm.
And it looks like I've pre-sold 500 of those already out of 1,000.
That's amazing.
Well, it's been fun. It's what a wonderful journey. And so if all goes well, we'll have that available in October.
Mm-hmm. All right, well, I'm knocking on wood for you. I'm going to let you go because we've got about a minute left. And thank you so much. And when the book is ready to come out, I'm referring to the more general book, when you're ready to go ahead and have that be out, or the limited edition if you wish to, please get in touch and we'll come back on so that people can be reminded about it.
That would be wonderful. I appreciate it.
All right,
Jeff,
Scott.
Thank you so much for
thanks very
me
much.
Me.
You, it's been great for me as well. Thank you very much. Take care.
Have a good night.
Bye-bye. Mm-hmm. You too. Bye-bye. And that was Scott Foster. And again, you can see his book at themagicsnowflake.com. Thank you for joining us. And if you didn't like the show, make sure to get in touch with us and tell us how to improve. If you did like it, tell all of your friends. and let them know that they can tune in as well. We're about out of time. Thank you very much. Join us next week for Larry Hancock, and let us know if you want the newsletter at jb720@cox.net. Thanks again. Have a great night. Talk to you next week. Bye-bye.